We're studying the book of Genesis, and we're in chapter 9. And last time we covered the first 7 verses, sort of. Those verses had a lot of subjects that required some lengthy consideration. It's right after the flood. Noah and his family come out of the ark, and God has some new orders, some new commands. Among them was that mankind would start eating animals for the first time, or at least for the first time with God's sanction. Until that time, from the time of creation until the flood, God had only really authorized the eating of plant foods, but now he actually told Noah and his family to eat animals. He even said every manner of animals. He didn't divide it into clean and unclean animals like he later did under the law. Which is really kind of interesting when you think that already, before the flood, there was a distinction between clean and unclean beasts because God told Noah to bring 7 each of the clean and 2 each of the unclean. So they had that distinction between animals, but it did not pertain to eating animals. It pertained to offering sacrifices. Now, when he does give them permission for the first time to eat animals, he doesn't make that distinction of clean and unclean, though he later did in the time of Moses. He also said that they should not eat blood. There was a second thing that showed up here for the first time in chapter 9 after the flood. They could eat animal flesh, but they had to drain all the blood out. Because he said, the blood, which is its life, that's the Lord's. And only God can create life. Man can rearrange things that God has made into new arrangements and inventions and such, but no one can make life where there isn't already life. And God alone can do that. And that makes life sacred. It makes life something very much in God's realm. It's His entirely. And so he wanted mankind to show that, honor to that, by pouring out the blood of slaughtered animals before consuming them. And you pour it out, as an offering to the Lord in draining it out. And so later on, the Jews actually had very careful methods of draining all the blood they could out of their meat before they ate it. And actually, I suppose everyone should have done that from the time of Noah on. Gentile nations who didn't follow God's laws in later times actually not only ate the meat with blood in it, but actually sometimes part of their pagan rituals would drink bowls of blood and of their victims and so forth. And that's the kind of thing that God found abominable. And then the last new instruction that came after they came out of the ark that we saw last time was that whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. In other words, authorization of capital punishment, and making an obvious distinction between murder and capital punishment. Whoever murders shall be subject to capital punishment, he said. And therefore, murder is such a heinous crime that it is punishable by death. But capital punishment isn't a crime at all. In fact, it's a virtue. It's justice being served. And that had never been stated by God previously, but it became stated here. And as we know, when the law came later on in Moses' time, there were all kinds of laws about capital punishment. Not only murderers, but people who committed some 30 different offenses were subject to capital punishment, including kidnapping and cursing your parents and a whole lot of other things. Now we come to verse 8, and this is new material for us tonight. Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, "And as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, of all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth. Thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." And God said, "This is the sign of the covenant, which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you. For perpetual generations I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. And it shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth, that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, The water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on earth. Now, although it doesn't say so in quite so many words, it certainly gives the impression that this was the first time that the rainbow appeared as a phenomenon in the sky associated with rain. There are some who study the Bible who believe it possible it was not only the first time that the rainbow appeared, but that the flood was the first time that rain appeared, which is why the rainbow had never appeared before. It would seem that the natural features of the atmosphere and of light passing through the vapor in the atmosphere, those features that make a rainbow appear today, would cause rainbows to have appeared before the flood if there was similar atmosphere and rain and all those things. I mean, the physics would presumably be the same. And therefore, if rainbows appeared for the first time after the flood, then it is possible to extrapolate that maybe rain had never happened before the flood. And that would make it an interesting kind of a promise when he says, whenever there's a cloud that comes, I'll put the rainbow there. Imagine if mankind had never seen rain before the flood, but then after the flood had dried up and gone, it rained again. You know, I mean, think of how nervous that would make people who were old enough to remember the flood. You know, I mean, if they'd never seen rain before the flood, and the only time it ever rained was when it wiped out everything, and then after they've come out of the flood and built their houses and they don't have a big boat anymore, and, you know, the clouds gather and the rain comes again, it'd be pretty scary. But God said, okay, every time that happens, you'll see this rainbow in the clouds, and that'll be your reminder. In fact, he doesn't say it'll be your reminder. He says, that'll be my reminder. I will see it, he said, and I will remember the covenant that I've made with you. So the rainbow is a way of sort of, reaffirming at times when people might become nervous about whether God was going to flood the earth again, that he had promised that he won't, and the rainbow, therefore, is an emblem of his promise and of his faithfulness. By the way, the word rainbow in the Hebrew is not any different than the word for a bow, like bow and arrow, like a weapon bow in the Hebrew language. And, of course, you have the word used that way in a number of places in Scripture, because there's a lot of stories about wars and bows and arrows and so forth in the Bible. But the rainbow in the Hebrew just is bow. It's just, I'll put my bow in the earth. It's the same word as if he was saying, I'm going to put my battle bow up in the cloud. And some have felt, and I kind of felt this instinctively when I learned that too, but it reminds me of the old westerns where the gunfighter wants to hang up his guns. You know, he's tired of bloodshed, and he's tired of, you know, a career of killing, and he's, you know, the movie always starts with him hanging up his guns, and always, you know, in the climax of the movie, he has to take them down again because some new trouble has arisen. He's not going to be able to get away with hanging up his guns for good because he's got to come to the rescue of someone. But the hanging up of the guns is like symbolic of saying, I'm done with this. I don't want to do, I'm tired of the killing. You know, I'm taking a new path from here. And God says, okay, I'm going to hang my bow up. Like I've been fighting. I was at war with humanity when I sent this flood. It's as if my weapon was in my hand. And now I'm going to hang it up. You'll see it's hanging there still. Every time there's a rain and you fear that maybe God's mad again and he's maybe going to wipe us all out, check it out. My bow's still hanging up there over the door, you know. And what's interesting is that in Ezekiel chapter 1, Ezekiel saw a vision of God's chariot, and he saw the rainbow over God's throne. God's chariot and his throne were there. It was a vision. And over the throne was the rainbow, which also appeared when John saw the throne of God in heaven in Revelation chapter 4. He saw the throne of God in heaven, and he saw the rainbow over it there too. Which reminded, I'm sure, the prophets when they saw it, that God still had his mercy, his faithfulness to his promise is still established. He's got his bow hanging up there right over his chair in his throne room. Some have thought, and I don't know if there's any value of this, but it's an interesting thought, that when in the book of Revelation, when the first seal is broken of the seven sealed book, and it's the first action that really takes place in the book of Revelation, the first seal is broken in chapter 6, of Revelation, and a rider is seen on a white horse going forth, and he has a bow in his hand. And there's about a zillion different interpretations of who that rider is and what the bow represents and so forth. But some have suggested that the bow in the hand, because this is the beginning of God's judgments on whoever it is that's being judged in the book of Revelation, that it's as if, you know, what John sees is that bow that's been hanging up over the throne, not in use for so many centuries, now that the time has come for God's signal and devastating judgments, you know, he's taken the bow down again, he's gone back to war again. And the judgments that come in the book of Revelation would be, you know, what follows as a result of that. That is only one of many possible interpretations, but nonetheless, it is the case that when God says, I'll put my bow in the clouds, the word he used would be that of a battle bow. I'm hanging up my bow. He's got a very colorful bow. And he actually has a lot of them because you can sometimes see more than one of them at a time. But every time you see a rainbow, it is God's way of reminding you that he is not going to destroy the earth with a flood again. Although, when you see a rainbow, it is usually when there is rain. And that's what caused the flood in the first place. The judgment of the whole world is going to happen in the future. There will be another judgment of the whole race, except for the remnant. But it will not be by water. According to 2 Peter chapter 3, the world that has been in existence since the flood is currently kept in store by God's promise, by God's word, being prevented from being destroyed until the day of the last day of the judgment of fire, where the elements will be burned up and the cosmos will be burned up. And that will be a similar judgment, only with a different element. Instead of water, it'll be by fire. Another difference is that when God destroyed the world by water, he only saved 8 people in the ark. Whereas when he destroys the world in the end, there will be a lot more than 8 people. All who have come into the ark of safety, which is Christ, will be spared that judgment. And that'll be the very final judgment. There's two times in God's dealings with man where he judges the whole human race, with the exception of the few who have come into safety out of obedience to him. The flood in Noah's day, and then the judgment when Jesus returns. And so the flood is a very obviously a unique thing. It's not just another miracle in the Bible, of which there are many. It's not even just another judgment, of which there are many in the Bible. But it's a judgment that foreshadows the judgment of the whole world. But it did so with water. It will be with fire next time, according to Peter. Now, in verse 18, we have this rather disappointing story beginning here, the last story of Noah's life. It says, now the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. And then we have this story about them and Noah. Now, should point out that from these three sons and their wives, the whole world was populated. So they were like the new Adam and Eve, only there were three couples instead of one to repopulate the earth. And they did. And in chapter 10 of Genesis, it's usually called the Table of Nations. And it goes through each one of these three sons and tells who their children were and what nations came from them. And every one of us here have come from one of these three sons of Noah. And you can kind of discover which one you came from by reading chapter 10 and discovering what nations came from which. Now, of course, there's not a listing of Americans in there, but then Americans are not an ethnic group anyway. We're talking about ethnic nations. But one thing that's interesting about the way this is introduced in verse 18, it mentions at the end of verse 18 that Ham was the father of Canaan. Now, Ham was actually the father of quite a few sons. Canaan was one. And Canaan wasn't even the firstborn. Canaan was not the oldest son. So why is he mentioned? It doesn't mention in this verse Shem's sons, any of them, or Japheth's. And of Ham's sons, only one is mentioned, Canaan. Why? Well, because Canaan gave rise to the Canaanites. And the Canaanites were the people that inhabited the land that later came to belong to Israel. Actually, Joshua and the Israelites had to drive the Canaanites out of the land because they were under God's curse. The story that follows in the rest of chapter 9 tells us something about why the Canaanites were under God's curse. And this man, Canaan, who was the only descendant of Ham that is mentioned in this chapter, though others are mentioned in chapter 10, was the ancestor of these races of people that the Jews had to eventually drive out of the land that they took. Now, remember that Moses wrote this book. Moses wrote Genesis. And he wrote it a long time after these events. Now, these events about Noah happened at least probably 1,000 years before Moses lived. And that being so, let's see here. I'd say, yeah, at least 1,000 years before Moses, the flood in this story happened. But Moses wrote it for his own contemporaries. When Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt, it was with the stated design was that they're going to go to Canaan. They're going to go and capture the land and defeat the Canaanites and take their land. That's what the plan was. Now, they got delayed for 40 years because of their disobedience, but they ended up doing it anyway. A generation later under Joshua's leadership. Now, when Moses wrote this story for his fellow Israelites who had come out of Egypt, this story had great significance for them because the Canaanites who derive from this man Canaan, who is mentioned in this story, are the ones they were on their way when he wrote this story. They were on their way to defeat these people and to take their land from them. And that being so, there was a reason for Moses to include this story. Moses would have reason for the Israelites to know that there was a long-standing grudge that God had against the Canaanites, and that by Israel going in and taking their land, this was the ultimate in God's carrying out a long-predicted vengeance against them. And so the story about Canaan, really Canaan isn't in the story as an actor, but he is in it as a recipient of a curse. And that's what this story is about that we're about to read in verse 20. Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard. Now, it says he began to be a farmer. That language sounds as if maybe this was a new career for him. Started a new career at age 600 years old. You know, midlife crisis, probably. And he started farming for the first time. What was he before the flood? A shipbuilder. What else? You know, I mean, now he's... so he starts being a farmer now. And the fact that this was new to him might, but might not, give some explanation for what happened afterwards. He planted a vineyard. Then he drank of the wine and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. And Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it on both their shoulders and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away and they did not see their father's nakedness. So Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done to him and said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants he shall be to his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. And may God enlarge Japheth, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant." Now, the story really is about Noah sinning. But as a result of the story, Canaan gets a curse upon his head. And it's not entirely clear why, because Canaan wasn't even a player in the story, as far as we know. I mean, he's not mentioned as having done anything. It was Ham, Canaan's father, who is reported to have done whatever was done. And Canaan gets the curse upon him. And so it raises some questions about what's going on in this story. And, you know, what's it all about? Well, Noah got drunk, okay? Now, we know that before the flood, he was said to be, unlike everyone else of his generation, he was uniquely righteous, perfect before God. Many have felt that his drunkenness was sort of an innocent accident, in that, now, we have no way of knowing if this is true or not, but some have felt the atmospheric conditions after the flood were different in important ways than what they had been before, and that fermentation of grapes happened more rapidly or differently than before the flood, and that this was a new thing, that the fermentation of his vintage caught him by surprise. I mean, it was his vintage time. He harvested the grapes. He drank the wine and he got drunk, but maybe did not know how strong the alcohol was. It's hard to know. A good man can make a mistake like that. But on the other hand, a good man can also sometimes sin. I mean, we don't know if this was totally innocent. It might have been kind of depressing being the only people in the world. Might have gotten lonely. Maybe he wanted to get drunk. We don't know. We just don't know. We can't say that Noah was, did something innocently or that he didn't do something innocently here. The story is not given in that kind, doesn't give that kind of editorializing. All we know is what he did. And really, when you read about good people in the Bible, you also, in almost every case, very few exceptions, you read about bad things they did. Abram did some bad things in the Bible. Jacob did too. So did Solomon. So did David. And these men were largely good men, at least in the beginning of their stories. And when it tells of their sin, it tells about it in a very matter-of-fact way, like, so what else is new, I mean, you read of them doing bad things, and it doesn't tell the story with great shock or horror, although what they did is bad and not excusable. It's just that sin is not that unusual in our race, and even good men sometimes have fallen. And Noah, his general reputation for being a righteous man is not necessarily impugned if he fell this once, whether he was somewhat aware of what he was doing or not. We don't have any record that he became a drunkard as a habit. He may have gotten drunk this one time and repented and never done it again. We don't know. But it does show us some things about what alcohol does to people. Because when he got drunk, he lost his inhibitions and took off his clothes. And he wasn't out in public, whatever public would have meant back in those days. I guess public would be the living room of the family. But he was in his tent alone, and he was laying on the bed. Who knows, it may have been hot. He had thrown his clothes off him, but he was simply so out of it from drunkenness that he didn't even know he was exposed like that. Now, we might not have all the same inhibitions people did back then, but maybe we should. We might not be ashamed, if a family member walked in and saw us naked. But in the biblical times, Adam and Eve, who were a married couple, were even ashamed when they had sinned, and they were embarrassed to be in front of each other naked. Now, that doesn't mean that married couples shouldn't be in front of each other naked, but it does mean that there was much more sensitivity about the significance of being uncovered. We live in a society where people uncover themselves to such a great degree, even when they're not thinking of themselves being immodest. I mean, a great deal of skin is shown just routinely in our culture from clothing styles. And then, of course, you've got movies and advertisements that show people with particularly little on or nothing at all in some cases. And we become desensitized to the inappropriateness of nakedness being exposed in the wrong form to the wrong eyes. But you see, Noah and his family knew very well that it was inappropriate for someone to be looking on their father's nakedness. Now, this would not be because of any, I'm sure, not because of any sexual temptation associated with it. Because after that, the man was 600 years old. And his sons were married men. It's not like there's any suggestion here necessarily of sexual, innuendos at all. It simply was more, I think, the symbolism and the inappropriateness of exposing oneself or looking upon someone who had exposed himself. Now, Ham could hardly be faulted if he walked into his dad's tent not knowing what he'd see there and saw his dad, and, if he quickly walked out again. And we don't even know for sure if Ham, looked a long time or left quickly or whatever he did. There are actually people who, when it says when Noah woke up from his wine and he knew what his younger son had done to him, there are people who'd like to suggest that something more was even done besides just looking. But there's no reason to suggest it. because we're simply told that Ham went in and saw. And there's no sin in him accidentally coming in and seeing. It's what he did after that when he left the tent. His father he saw in an undignified state, in a state that he knew his father would prefer not to be seen in. And he could have done, when he walked in and found his father, he could have done exactly what the other two brothers did. He could say, oh my goodness, you know, my dad has no idea. I mean, he'd be so embarrassed if he knew that. I'll just cover him up and leave and won't say a word to anyone. And, you know, just no one will have to know. In that case, he would have honored his father because he suddenly became privy to information about his father that was shameful. His father was shamefully drunk. His father was in an undignified form and didn't even know it. And Ham had perhaps, through no fault of his own, become aware of this, but he could have remedied it. He could have covered his dad up and said nothing, and the secret would have, you know, died with him. And his father's dignity would have been spared publicly. But instead, Ham went out and he spoke to his brothers about this. Now, what's the point of that? But to gossip. Really, I mean, what his brothers end up doing, he could have done without speaking to them about it. It's very clear that he was amused, or else in some other sense felt it was, he had some juicy gossip that no one else knew, and he's going to get the credit to be the first one to tell the story, you know. And he went out and he found the only other people on the planet, and he publicized to everyone, at least to his brothers, what his dad had done. Now, to my mind, this is very parallel to what many people, including Christians, sometimes do. You know, children, because they grow up in their parents' homes, see their parents in their most shameful states. I'm not saying they see their parents naked and things like that. Some do, some don't. But I mean, they see the most shameful behavior. They see their parents at their worst, as well as probably at their best. And, I mean, unless they have perfect parents, then children always see imperfections in their parents because they are in the right place at the right time to see it when no one else is. Most people, you know, if imperfections in their life are made visible, they're made visible in the privacy of the home more often than anywhere else. And the children there, simply by virtue of being in the home, see and know and learn a great deal more about their parents' faults than any other human beings are likely to learn. In that sense, it's a great commendation to parents when kids grow up respecting their parents. I mean, when kids actually grow up and think well of their parents, that's a pretty good testimonial, since kids see so much. But at the same time, the very act of bringing children into the home, by doing so, the parents make themselves and their reputations totally vulnerable. If their children are loose-lipped and gossip and malicious, because let's face it, the parents are imperfect. Parents do things that are wrong. And if kids go out and tell those things, then they are exposing, as it were, the nakedness of their parents, that which should be kept private, that which should be kept, you know, covered. The Bible says that he that covers a transgression seeks love, but he that repeats a matter, you know, is separating very friends, it says in Proverbs. And I've often thought about this when I've heard people give their testimonies. You know, many times when people give their testimonies, they talk about their parents, of course. I mean, people tend to tell their story. They start talking about their family life when they grew up. And, you know, you can't avoid that if you're going to tell about how you grew up. But at the same time, sometimes I wince when I hear people telling about their family life because they had parents who were alcoholics or wife beaters, or who abandoned the home, you know, when they were little and treated them badly, and they tell these parts of the story. And I dare say there are times when something about the story requires that some of that background probably needs to be told in order to that the story be understood in its context. But I think a person ought to be mighty, mighty careful about revealing publicly what their parents did that was not commendable. Not because you are obligated to lie about your parents or give a better impression of your parents than is true, but because you are in a better position than anyone else to tell what's wrong with your parents, which is not what you're, that's not what they brought you into the world to do. You know, parents deserve honor. And one of the commandments that God gave at Mount Sinai was honor your father and your mother. Ham could have honored his father. He had the opportunity. You know, when you see your parents in a shameful condition or doing something that is would be embarrassing to be known, you are in a position to decide, what will I do with this information? If you honor your father and your mother, it means you don't go out and spread it around to everybody, especially if it's not something they would like to have known. I mean, if your parents get up and give testimony to it themselves and make it public, then I suppose maybe there's, even then, there's not much reason for you to do so because they've already done it. But children need to be careful to treat their parents with reverence and with honor. And children, even grown children, of course, grown children understand this better than young children do, but children owe their parents so much, even if they had the worst parents imaginable. If your parents were the worst parents of anyone you know, you still can't deny the fact that they brought you into the world when they could have aborted you. They supported you when they could have not done so. And in fact, you know, there are some parents who didn't even do that much. I mean, there are some parents who just abandon their kids and never even see them. There's not an awful lot of good things to say about parents like that. But one thing can be said is that God used that person to bring you into the world. And if that person didn't cooperate happily with God and didn't have a sense of the importance of what they're doing and didn't even care about the offspring they brought in the world, yet God did. And God is the one who puts the solitary in families. God is the one who brought you into the world and gave you the parents you did. And you might say, well, great, thanks, God. You know, why didn't you give me something better? Well, maybe someday he'll tell you why he didn't give you something better. But in the meantime, he gave you what he gave you so that that'd be part of the whole furniture of your life, so that you could take those raw materials that you were handed and make from it exactly what God knows you can and should make of that. I mean, if you're given a worse upbringing because you didn't have very good parents than someone else, well, maybe God doesn't expect you to make as much of your life, but maybe he does. Maybe he knows that the disadvantage you have are the very things that can strengthen you in other ways that you wouldn't be strong otherwise. The point is, though, there were only two people on the planet that were used to bring you into the world, and God is the one who picked them. And God is the one who picked you to be brought into the world by them. And it was God's choice. And when God says, honor your father and mother, you honor him by honoring them. And I realize that some parents are so negligent and so abusive that it's hard to know any tangible way that they should be honored. But one way that they can be is by guarding their secrets. And that's what Ham didn't do. I mean, Noah was a commendable man. Let's face it. I mean, the memory of Noah is a positive memory in general. He's a uniquely righteous man in his generation. But we would never have known this story if Ham hadn't told anyone. You know, Noah could have died with a great reputation, and I think he deserved to. I mean, he wasn't perfect. This is the only sin that's ever recorded that he did. He probably did other sins, but nothing that was worth writing home about. And the fact that Ham told this story became the occasion of this story being told to us. And we're not talking about far removed historical character. We're talking about our own ancestor. Noah is our great, 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 great grandfather too. And so all of us, you know, have learned this shameful thing about Noah because one man, the man who had the opportunity to either honor his father and conceal the secret, didn't choose to do that. He chose to dishonor him and talk about it. Now, my impression is that Ham probably told his brothers about it in sort of a mocking tone. It's not necessary to assume that. He may have just reported it, you know, like, you know how people gossip. They always talk about, oh, this is a terrible thing. We need to, you know, you need to be aware of this. Not like we're gossiping, but because this is important. This is significant information for us to know. You know, Dad's in really a bad way in there. But I have a feeling, though I don't know for sure, that Ham may have tended to mock his father as he told his brothers. At least whether he did so in a mocking tone or not, that was the effect of it. Because those brothers didn't have to know about it. There was no reason they needed to know about this. And we might say, well, if they hadn't been told, they wouldn't have gone in and covered him up, so it was good that they found out. But he could have covered him up. That's the point. He could have covered his father's own nakedness and never mentioned. And I think I think we need to realize that this man got his son got a curse upon him, and his descendants got a curse upon them for many generations afterwards, because he simply didn't honor his father at a time when he could have. And you know, not every case of dishonoring your parents ends up having such long range ramifications, but you never know when it will. It says in Proverbs, the eye that mocks his father, and I can't quote this exactly, you know, mocks his mother, the ravens of the field will pluck it out. You know, I mean, God's got gruesome ends for people who disrespect their parents, and that's why he said, honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God gives you to possess. And that isn't so much a promise that every individual can claim, that if I honor my parents, I won't die young, because Jesus died young, and I'm sure he honored his parents. And other people die young, some of whom are righteous people and probably treated their parents well. But he was saying, you Israel, you as a nation can possess this land for a long time if you honor your parents as a national policy. If you adopt this as an ethic for your society, that you honor your father and mother, then you as a society will be able to live long in this land instead of being thrust out of the land like he did to the Canaanites. Why? Because the Canaanites were thrust out of the land because of dishonored parents. Because Ham, Canaan's father, dishonored his father. The Canaanites came under a curse, which was realized later on in the days of Joshua. Now, I won't go into great detail preaching against alcohol here, although much can be said, and I will say something about it. It's a good opportunity to, because this is the first mention of alcohol and its effects in the Bible. Later on, Lot also did shameful things because of alcohol. His daughters both got him drunk and got him to do things he would never have agreed to do sober. And the one thing about alcohol that seems to make it so bad is that it strips a person of their moral judgment. It deprives people of moral judgment. It says in Hosea chapter 4, I think it's verse 11, it says, wine and new wine and harlotry take away the heart. Or I think the New King James says, enslave the heart. But if you look over at, there's a number of places in the Bible that give this idea, but if you look over at Proverbs chapter 30, well, let's look at, we're going to look at 30, but let's look at chapter 23 first. My kids and I read this last night because it was the 23rd of the month and we read the 23rd chapter of Proverbs together. But it ends with this little litany against drinking. This chapter does. In Proverbs 23:29, who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? That is, who fights a lot? Who has complaints? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who linger long at the wine, those who go in search of mixed wine. Do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Now, he says in verse 33, implying, if you drink too much alcohol, it says, then your eyes will see strange things and your heart will utter perverse things. Now, it means your heart will dictate evil behavior to you that it would not dictate to you if you weren't drinking the wine. The wine actually affects the heart and your judgment. Yes, you'll be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, or one who lies at the top of the mast, saying, they have struck me and I was not hurt. I didn't feel it, feeling no pain. They have beaten me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake that I may seek another drink? It says this is the addictive nature of alcohol. You have a, you know, this ghastly, you know, sensation like seasickness, like sleeping up at the top of a mast of a ship. You know, you get kind of woozy and kind of sick from that, and you get, even if you get in a fight and get beat up and you're bruised and bloody, you didn't even feel it, and say, hey, you know, this is hurting me, but I don't feel it. That's the problem. You see, alcohol in excess puts you out of touch with reality, even the reality of when you're hurting yourself. And it's also true if you're hurting yourself morally. You're not aware of it when you're drunk as you are at other times. You have a conscience when you're sober that will say, don't do that. But when you drink too much, that conscience is numbed and you lose your moral judgment. That's what Proverbs chapter 30 says. And this is in instructions given by a mother to her son, the king, King Lemuel. And his mother gave him these instructions in Proverbs 31. And she said in verse 4, "It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of all the afflicted." So she said, the leaders shouldn't drink. In fact, Paul said, when he gives the qualifications for elders, said they should not be given to much wine. Actually, he says of elders, they shouldn't be given to wine, and to deacons says they should not be given to much wine. I'm not sure if there's a difference there, but the point is, it's the same reason. It's not for leaders who have to make judgment calls. It's not for those who need to provide moral leadership to drink, because why? His mother told him, and she was right. If you drink, you lose touch with moral issues. You forget the law. You pervert judgment, because that's just the effect of intoxication. That's why men, when they want to seduce women, try to get them drunk, because a woman who would not otherwise succumb to seduction will do so much more readily if she's drunk, because she loses her natural inhibitions. She and men do the same to themselves, because they like to get over their inhibitions. But getting over your inhibitions, you know, that might be fun if you want to sin, but it's the most dangerous thing you can do if you want to go to heaven. Your inhibitions and your conscience are the best protection you have against doing things that are going to send you straight to hell. And therefore, to numb those, or hey, it might be fun for a little while, but you do serious damage to your soul. And much of it is, of course, addictive. When shall I rise and get another drink? I got beat up last time. I don't know where all these bruises are, and I don't know where this new tattoo came from either. But I know that I'm ready for another drink. You know, I mean, it's just like, you know, addictive. You can see the damage it's doing to you, but you still don't have the good sense to stop it. Because, of course, alcohol is something that makes you physically addicted. Now, interestingly, and I guess most evangelicals wouldn't read these verses in Proverbs 31, but we might as well, they're in the Bible too. Verse 6 says, "Give strong drink to him who's perishing, and wine to those who are bitter of heart. Let them drink and forget his poverty, and remember his misery no more." Oh, okay, so if people are really depressed, get them drunk, right? I don't think that's what it's saying. I think what it's saying is, I think this is almost something like a biblical sanction for anesthesia for people who are dying miserably, you know, numbing their pain a little bit. Today we'd use, you know, morphine-based, you know, drugs or something like that. You know, if you're dying of some horrible, painful thing, that, you know, the doctor gives you some kind of painkillers. Back then, they didn't have those. They just had wine for that purpose. In fact, when they used to have to amputate arms from people, they didn't really have a clean way to do that. They just took a saw out and sawed the arm off. But first, they got a person real drunk, which, frankly, I don't know. I mean, I don't believe in getting drunk, but if I'd have my arm sawed off and there was no other way to numb me, I wouldn't mind maybe just this once, you know? Just this once, you know? I'm not doing it to get drunk. I'm doing it to retain my sanity while I'm in excruciating pain. The Bible almost seems to approve of that, or at least this woman who gave advice to Lemuel seemed to approve of that. You know, if people are in that much pain and perishing, you know, as an anesthesia, maybe, you know. The problem is that sinful drinking, that which drunkards do, they don't do it as anesthesia. They don't do it for medicinal purposes. In other words, they do it for recreational purposes, and it damages their moral judgment. Now, having said all that about wine, what about other consciousness-altering drugs? I mean, everything I've said about wine, it's not about grapes. It's about consciousness-altering drugs, one in particular called alcohol. There's others. There's other kinds of consciousness-altering drugs that don't come from grapes. They come from poppies and other things, you know, and certain types of grasses and such. And you know, are we supposed to, what's wrong with those? Well, the main thing is, if God has an objection to people numbing their consciousness through alcohol because the moral judgment is impaired that way, then I think it's, you know, if we're not going to be legalistic and say, well, God never said anything about opium, you know, God never said anything about heroin, never said anything about cocaine. Well, the question is, what is it he objects to about being intoxicated by alcohol? And can we extrapolate from that that he might find the same objection to doing the same kind of damage to your moral judgment by other substances that they didn't have back then to condemn? Maybe they did have some of these to condemn, but I don't know. But I've never myself chosen to use drugs, even though when I was a teenager, almost all my friends did. Because, for one thing, I was concerned about my moral judgment. I knew that I had enough trouble staying morally pure without fighting against myself in that matter. And I know, for example, that friends of mine who smoked a lot of marijuana, they seemed to lose their moral judgment not only when they were high, but when they came down, they still didn't have much moral judgment. It seemed like marijuana had an effect eventually on just changing their whole moral structure of their consciousness. I mean, the people I know who smoked a lot of dope, even when they weren't high, seemed to have much less moral sense than they'd had before they had started smoking dope, if I knew them beforehand, and certainly more than the people I know who didn't smoke it. I realize that to people who aren't Christians, and maybe to some who are, the temptation is really great to do something chemical to your brain because it's a sensation that some people find pleasant. But a Christian has got to be committed to holiness, has got to be committed to doing what's right all the time. And although we don't do what's right all the time, it should bother us that we don't. And we should do everything we can to prevent ourselves from, we shouldn't handicap ourselves unnecessarily. I mean, if it's hard enough to know the will of God when you're sober, you're not making it any easier when you get drunk or get high on any kind of a drug. And so you can't very well pass this story about Noah without making those observations, because this is the first case of somebody using chemicals to alter their consciousness. First case on record. There were probably times before the flood when people did those kind of things. I don't know. But and look what it did. It caused the man to do things he would never have approved of doing. He would have never laid in his tent in that condition, vulnerable to be seen that way, if he had not been drunk. And that's just the point. When you're sober, you've got a much better idea of what is appropriate to do and what's inappropriate to do. But when you surrender your sobriety to a chemical, you lose those inhibitions, you lose that moral judgment, and you work against your own self if it is your goal to do what's right and to live in a way pleasing to God. Now, let's talk about the curse that came on Canaan and what was said about these other boys. So Noah woke from his wine in verse 24 and knew what his younger son had done to him. There had been no record of his younger son doing anything except telling his brothers, which did do something to his dad. It kind of wrecked his dad's reputation somewhat. You know, it says in Proverbs, or Ecclesiastes actually, it's not in Proverbs, it's in Ecclesiastes, that as dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking smell, so does a little folly to a man who has a reputation for wisdom. That is, dead flies are not very big little animals. I mean, a stinking corpse of a cow, you expect it to smell up the whole room. But a dead fly doesn't usually give off much of an odor that you'd notice across the room. But a dead fly in the apothecary's perfume, it spoils the perfume. That's what he says. You know, dead flies in the apothecary's ointment cause it to send forth a stinking smell. It might be a little rottenness in a large vat, but it still defiles it. It's like how many drops of ink do you have to put into a pure pitcher of water to make it not be a pure water anymore? I mean, just one drop of ink just discolors the whole water. And it says that's what it's like when somebody who has a reputation for wisdom does a little bit of folly. It doesn't take much folly to spoil a good reputation. Noah would otherwise be remembered simply as a wise man, a wise and good man. But just one thing we know, we only know of one sin he committed. He may have committed more, but this is the only one we know about. One little bit of folly, what does it do? It causes his reputation to stink. And you need to bear that in mind, as I said, when you talk about anybody, but especially when you talk about your parents to people who don't know them. You know, I mean, your parents, in all likelihood, did more things kindly to you than wrong to you. Now, that may, there may be exceptions. There may be parents who did more wrong things than right things, but that's not likely to be the case very often. Jesus said even that evil fathers give good gifts to their children. Because that is the case. I mean, if you didn't starve to death in the first 10 years of your lifetime, then somebody was feeding you. It was probably your parents, and it probably wasn't free to them. They probably worked, and they probably labored, and they probably sacrificed a fair bit for you to be alive today. And your mother in particular, you know, just to bring you into the world. And your father, if he supported you in any sense, or whoever it was that was the father to you who did. Someone took care of you. And those persons deserve your respect and should be honored for that, even if there was some folly in their life. If you repeat that folly, it'll cause their reputation to stink like dead flies in the perfume. And that's what happened to Noah, really. And his son had done that to him. His son basically ruined his otherwise good reputation. I say, well, Noah should take responsibility for his own actions. I mean, if Noah hadn't gotten drunk, this couldn't have happened. It's Noah's fault. Why blame his son? Okay, it is Noah's fault. We won't deny this. Everybody's sin is their own fault. But that doesn't mean that sin is characteristic in the life of a godly man. It's uncharacteristic. But the person who hears about the sin doesn't know if it's uncharacteristic or not. It's the main thing that stands out. You know, when you hear of the story of David, you know, what do you remember most? Probably, but his sin with Bathsheba. It's because it stands out. One reason it stands out is in such a contrast to the rest of his life. If his whole life was seamlessly evil, you wouldn't particularly remember that sin above others. But because the man was a godly man, with a man after God's own heart, that one sin stands out like a sore thumb, and you can hardly think of the man without, you know. If you say, well, David was a righteous man, someone's going to say, oh, yeah, but didn't he do that thing with Bathsheba? I mean, it comes right to mind, doesn't it? Because it stands out in your mind, because it was uncharacteristic. And David deserves to be remembered for his sin as well. I mean, he took responsibility for it eventually. And you know, anyone who sins, you know, they can't complain if their sin finds them out. At the same time, it doesn't mean that they deserve all the bad reputation that comes from a sin. It might be the only time they ever did it. And they may have had temptation to do it 1,000 times and resisted valiantly all 999 times before, and they fell one time, and that's the one time it spoils their whole reputation. Got to be careful with people's reputations. Noah's son did something to him. He did something to his reputation. He knew what his younger son had done to him. And so Noah said, cursed be Canaan. Now, it's strange he didn't say cursed be Ham, because it was Ham who did whatever was done. But this was not just Noah ventilating his anger toward his son. Noah was prophesying. And we know that because of how this turned out hundreds of years later. This was a prophecy that Noah gave. The thing that Ham did simply gave occasion for it. And while, you know, he could have uttered a curse upon Ham, I suppose, it wasn't the descendants of Ham as a whole that this curse was coming upon. Prophetically, Noah knew that one of Ham's sons would come under God's curse. And this was a good opportunity to bring it up. In fact, some think that Canaan might have actually been involved with his dad in spreading it, the gossip about him or whatever. We don't know. The point is that Canaan, one of Ham's sons, came under the curse. Now, by the way, some people say, well, black people are under God's curse because they descended from Ham. Well, true enough, they did descend from Ham. But there is not a curse on Ham's descendants. There's a curse on one of his sons and that son's descendants. And as far as we know, Canaan was not black. It is true that the black African nations, according to chapter 10 of Genesis, did descend from Ham. But they were not under this curse. It wasn't Ham's whole family. It was this one son and his descendants. And there's no indication in the Bible that he was black. And we certainly know that people, you know, the Ethiopians and the Egyptians and the Libyans and so forth that are mentioned as descending from Ham were not under this curse. So, I mean, although some people have tried to use this curse from this story as an excuse for thinking badly of black people, especially when it says, and Canaan shall be a servant. Oh, well, the black people came under slavery. That's the fulfillment of this curse. These people haven't done their homework very well. Canaan and the modern blacks are not related to each other much more closely than we are related to them. I mean, one generation closer than we are to being related to everybody. cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants, which means the lowliest of slaves shall he be to his brethren. And his brethren meaning Japheth and Shem particularly, which were really his uncles. And he said, blessed be Jehovah, that's what the all capitals Lord is in the Hebrew, blessed be Jehovah, Yahweh, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. Now, Jehovah or Yahweh is here called the God of Shem. We do not know why, except it's prophetic. There is nothing in the story that indicates that Shem was somehow more godly than at least Japheth. He may have been more godly than Ham because he behaved more honorably toward his father, but Japheth and he both acted exactly the same way toward the father. There's no evidence from the life of Shem that he, above all his brothers, was more godly. He might have been. He might have been of the three, the one son who really was more pious, the one who really bought into his father's religion when the others kind of were nominal and not really into God that much. But at least prophetically it makes sense because the Shem's descendants were the Shemites, or we would call them Semites, which includes the Jewish people eventually. Now, of course, the Arabs are Shemites too. And there were many other races of Shemites, most of them now extinct, that lived in the Middle East in ancient biblical times. But usually when we think of Semites, and certainly biblically, the most important Semites in the biblical story are the people of Israel. We will read at the end of chapter 11 of the generations from Shem down to his most important descendant in Old Testament times, Abram. Abram was of Shem, and the Jews came from him. And therefore the Jews are Shemites, and God associated in the Old Testament, especially with the Jewish people, more than with any other race. And therefore to call Jehovah or Yahweh the God of Shem, no doubt anticipates this special relationship that some of Shem's descendants, those particularly descended from Abram, Isaac, and Jacob, would have with Jehovah. And so it's kind of a prediction that of these three boys, this one would be the one who would give rise to a line through which God would specially be associated and would have special blessing upon them, and that would be the Jewish people in Old Testament times. And then he says in verse 27, may God enlarge Japheth, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. Now, Canaan's going to be the servant of all these guys, but what's he mean about Japheth? Japheth gave rise to most of the European races. Remember, most of this happened in what we would call, you know, Asia, the Middle East. The Jews are Asians. The Arabs are Asians, technically. But up west of Israel and to the north are the Western European nations. And that's where Japheth's descendants went. And most of us are descended from Japheth. There are some here who might have other ancestry that I don't know about, but most people who have European ancestry are Japhethites. As the Jews are Shemites or Semites, most of us are Japhethites. Now, what's interesting is that the prediction, the prophetic prediction, was that God would enlarge Japheth. And this could mean a number of things, but one thing it probably means is that Japheth's territory or his domain would be enlarged more than that of his brothers. And when you think about it, although Europe is not one of the largest continents, it was Europeans that went out and discovered the other continents. I mean, basically, North and South America were after the Native Americans, as we call them, were discovered and populated and controlled by Japhethites. Australia also. And, of course, Britain, which are Japhethites, at one time had an empire that they said the sun never set on their flag because parts of India and the islands of the Pacific and parts of Africa, I mean, parts of the whole world, were under the British crown, which were Japhethites. I mean, God enlarged the territory of Japheth in a big way. But more important than that enlarging of Japheth is that next statement, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, which I believe means, I believe it's referring to the fact that the Gentiles, especially the European Gentiles, would in large measure embrace Shem's religion. He had already said that Yahweh was the God of Shem. And now the Japhethites are going to dwell in the same tent, the big tent, you know, the big family, as it were. They're going to be of the same family spiritually with the Shemites. Now, of course, Jesus said that the gospel would preach to all nations and disciples would be made of all nations. And this is true. It's not just the Japhethites. I mean, certainly Africa has had a lot of people converted in it. There's a lot of African Christians, a lot of Asian Christians, which would be largely not entirely clear what their ancestry is going back to Noah's time. But the point is, the majority of, well, Christianity spread, let's put it this way, initially, more among the Europeans. And for hundreds of years, before it ever came to Africa or Asia, Europe became essentially a Christian continent, embracing the God of Shem, embracing Yahweh through embracing the gospel of Jesus. I want to turn your attention over to Isaiah chapter 54, and then we're going to be done. Isaiah chapter 54. I'll read this, and there's a good chance that many of you won't have a clue what it's talking about, but I'll try to explain it after I've read a few verses. Sing, O barren, you who have not borne. Break forth into singing and cry aloud, you who have not labored with child. For more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married woman, says the Lord. Enlarge the place of your tent, and let them stretch out the curtains of your dwellings. Do not spare. Lengthen your cords and strengthen your stakes. For you shall expand to the right and to the left, and your descendants will inherit the nations and make the desolate cities inhabited. Now this chapter follows immediately after the most famous Old Testament chapter, Isaiah 53, which is the most clear prophecy of the sufferings of Christ in the Old Testament. And the chapter divisions are artificial. This is, as soon as it talks about the suffering of the Messiah and his glorification from suffering, it has this prophecy that the barren will bring forth more children than the married wife. Now, what's that all about? Well, we might not have a clue if Paul didn't quote this. Paul actually quoted these opening verses over in Galatians 4. And the way he applied them is the way, of course, we must apply them. And basically, without looking there in detail right now, you can look there later if you want, or you can look now if you want. I'm not going to turn there. In Galatians 4, Paul makes it very plain that the barren, in this case, is an image of the Gentile nations. And the married wife is Israel. Because Israel was married to God. Israel had a covenant with God, like married couples have covenant with each other. And the prediction here is that the barren woman, the woman that God had never brought forth any children through before, the Gentiles, is going to eventually have more children in God's family than the married wife Israel is, which was a strange concept back in Isaiah's day, because the Israelites were the only people who even knew about God. All the other Gentiles were worshiping idols and sacrificing their babies to stone images and things like that. Only the Israelites knew Yahweh. But this prediction is that eventually there will be more Gentiles, more of those from those nations that had been previously barren and had never borne children for God. They were going to have more children of God than would Israel, the married wife. And therefore Israel is exhorted to make her tent bigger. Enlarge the place of your tent. This is an exhortation to the Jewish people who were not at all prepared emotionally to include Gentiles in their family under their tent. But that's what they're being warned about. Enlarge your tent. Why? You're going to have a big family. There's going to be a lot more kids coming in that you are not anticipating, the Gentiles who are going to be converted into their spiritual family. Let them stretch out the curtain of your dwellings. Do not spare. Lengthen your cords and strengthen your stakes. Why? Because you will expand to the right hand and the left, and your descendants will inherit the nations. The Gentiles, the nations are the Gentiles. And so this is a prediction that the Gentiles will come into the tent of Shem. You know, Japheth will inhabit the tents of Shem, as Noah said. And the Jews who are descended from Shem had better adjust to the idea, better get their, in their own mind, extend the boundaries of their family dwelling, because they're going to have a bigger family than they anticipate. Better make a bigger tent, extend its borders. Make the pegs strong, because it's going to have to hold up. It's going to have to be big. Because although God chose the descendants of Shem initially to be the people through whom he would preserve his own knowledge and eventually even bring Christ into the world. The prediction was made way back in the days of Noah that eventually, particularly the Japhethites, but certainly the prediction does not exclude the Hamites and the other Shemites. The Japhethites probably first and in larger numbers came into the tents of Shem, but this in itself led to the fulfillment, or is leading to the fulfillment, of the Great Commission, where Jesus said, go and make disciples of all nations, and go into the highways and byways and compel them to come in. And so the missionary efforts, largely of the Japhethites over the centuries, have been to go out to Hamites and Japhethites and Shemites all over the world and to bring them in. And the tent that was once large enough for the family, because the family only included Israelites, now had to be made bigger. The vision had to be expanded, and the family considered more inclusive than before. And so that is really the fulfillment of what God said through Noah about the fate of, and really it's about the spiritual fate of these different families of his children. In the last two verses of Genesis 9 say, and Noah lived after the flood 350 years. So all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died, as all the people mentioned previously had done as well. Now next time, we'll probably get so far as to talk about the Tower of Babel. We have to look at the Table of Nations in chapter 10 and see who came from whom. And then chapter 11 we'll probably get into also and talk about the Tower of Babel. And by the end of chapter 11, Abraham is on the scene and he becomes the most important Old Testament character. And his story is given a lot more detail than that of anyone up to this point has been.